People of very attention.
Welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast 133. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at Avengers Infinity War, the flavour of the month movie from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which gives us the superhero equivalent of one of those cheesy paintings where every Hollywood actor ever is portrayed drinking together in a nightclub. There will be spoilers here, so don't go complaining to your mum if you hear something you didn't want to know about the movie. You've been warned. See the film first, then come back and listen to the podcast. I'm not here to make you wet your pants. Really. If you want to do that, I'll play 2 hours of Katy Perry's cover of Earth, Wind & Fire September for you. So let me get the contact details out of the way and we can get our serious superhero geek on. Martian Drive-In Podcast is a two-weekly podcast about science fiction, fantasy, and other genres, cinema and television. From George Méliès to the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the DC Extended Universe, anything's up for grabs in this podcast. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. And if you want to give feedback, you can go to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com and leave a voicemail or an email message. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, adult concepts and words may turn up. So if you're going to be listening to them with kids around, put on the headphones. Or if you can't do that, you're going to have a lot of explaining to do. Okay, how the hell is everybody? Yes, I've seen the movie. Yes, I've seen it twice. Once for free because somebody gave me a little card with $30 value for seeing movies in my local cinema on it. And given the fact that I can get concessions as well, I can see three movies on it. And I used one of those $10 of the $30 to watch Marvel Infinity Wars a second time, just so I could thoroughly cover it for the podcast, just for you people. The first time Sally and I went together at Gold Class, which is the posh cinema. It doesn't have many seats, all the seats recline, and waiters and waitresses bring you food and drink in on demand. So we saw it the first time on that. Unfortunately, we've got chairs fairly close to the front, so those enormous speaker stacks they have in cinemas really made the music just that little bit too loud. I'm sitting up the back of the cinema kind of guy, usually get the full panorama of it, but it wasn't a bad viewing apart from that. And we enjoyed ourselves. Didn't get any snacks this time because I'd just eaten a pizza, but it is nice getting somebody bringing you in a fresh espresso just before the movie starts, something I can't recommend highly enough. So just a reminder again, this is the last time I'm doing it. There will be spoilers all through this podcast, so please don't say you weren't warned. I'm going to put it in the title of the podcast. I mentioned it in the intro. I'm mentioning it now. If you still complain about it, and I know there are going to be assholes who'll do it just because I say this, if you're still going to complain about it, then it's on you. But before we do that, it's time for what I've been watching and what's been happening. I haven't been watching much on television apart from news programs and the usual political stuff that I watch. I have seen the first couple of episodes of the third season of The Expanse, which is a personal favorite at the moment, and it's on track. It's definitely there. With the limited budget they have, they tell the story incredibly well, and I'm fond of the ensemble cast. I'm very fond of the original material upon which it's based, and The Expanse novels I recommend to anybody. They're really accessible and good space opera. You really should check them out. So what have I been watching? I decided I was going to do something that I promised myself I wasn't going to do, but we bought the Blu-ray cheap, and so I did it. And I rewatched Justice League. And it was actually kind of useful rewatching it just to compare and contrast it with Avengers Infinity War, to see what happens when somebody does it right and to see what happens when somebody doesn't do it right. And Justice League is still bad. Even Gal Gadot couldn't save it. The CG mustache issue is still there. The characters aren't sketched out well at all. And there's not a decent villain. That's the thing that Marvel has really upped its game on. Hopefully it'll soon do the same with female representation. But the thing Marvel really does is in the last few Marvel movies, they've really brought their A game as far as creating villains is concerned. And I'll talk about that just a bit more when I do Infinity War. Two-dimensional villains are the bane of the DC Extended Universe. Jesse Eisenberg's Lex Luthor has some incredibly, incredibly, incredibly bad acting choices in it. And it's not at all written well either, which is the two strikes against it and it's just out. What's the point of the character in the DC Universe? Basically, he's there to be a bad guy. He's there to be an asshole. He's there to be a much nastier and crazy Mark Zuckerberg, or maybe even Elon Musk, though Tony Stark and Elon Musk are a much better matchup, given the fact that Elon Musk did a cameo in Iron Man 2. So, yeah, Justice League just didn't work. The effects were, in a lot of cases, very ropey, and Steppenwolf is a mocap. I'm not even sure it was mocap, but it's a computer-generated villain of some kind that really didn't work at all. A lot of people have said that, but seeing this in close proximity with viewing Infinity War twice, you can really see the missed opportunities there. And I'm not going to say they were stupid, dumb, ridiculous, or bureaucratic in doing this. All I can say is the movie with stronger villains would have been a much better film. I think that that's the major weakness of it, and the kind of fake by the numbers sentimentality of Superman's return. You know, basically, for fuck's sake, it didn't work. So I watched that again with Sal, and we both agreed that it didn't work. I did go into a little bit of an Asian action phase during the week, because a lot of Asian action films are becoming much, much more accessible here in Australia and are turning up for reasonable prices at JB Hi-Fi. And so I watched Ika Uwe's recent film, Headshot, which is just a balls-to-the-wall action film. Got the usual Bourne kind of plot line. You know, mystery man gets amnesia from a head injury, ends up in hospital, and turns out to be a majorly skillful martial artist with a lot of trade craft and a kick-ass attitude. And Ika Uwe does that kind of thing really well. It was filmed and is set in Indonesia, which is great. The more Indonesian action films I see, the more I want to go to Indonesia, though that's a little bit problematic for me at the moment, even though it is the closest big country to Australia. You're not going to get much nuanced characterization in this or anything like that, but as far as this genre is concerned, it's a pretty reasonable effort, and it's also good to keep up with what other parts of the world are doing as far as film's concerned, apart from the US, the UK, and Australia. Speaking of which, I saw Jackie Chan's almost latest movie, which was filmed predominantly in Sydney, though there are some bits that were filmed in Taiwan. It's one of those movies that was financed through a whole bunch of different companies, a whole bunch of different countries, and it's called Bleeding Steel, where Jackie Chan plays a usual super cop. You've got a science fiction aspect to it as well with super soldiers, and it's kind of ordinary. Jackie is in his early 60s now. Let's see, 64 this year. And it's starting to show he's still got the kind of charisma, but he doesn't use it as well as he used to. And the action scenes are still very much kind of as they were 20 or 30 years ago, which is a little bit sad. But there's a lot more gunplay in them than a lot of Jackie Chan movies. And there's also some incredibly silly action sequences involving falling out of a giant floating platform, a little bit like a shield helicarrier from a Marvel movie, involving some parachutes and some improbable rescuing that goes on in this film. The only saving grace of this, and it's basically a setting thing more than anything else, is Jackie Chan gets to do a really good action sequence, fight sequence, with a very tall, dark-haired Caucasian woman on top of Sydney's Opera House. Now, it's a little bit of a nod in some ways, I suppose, to The Man from Hong Kong, where Roger Ward and Sammo Hung had a fight on top of Uluru, otherwise known as Ayers Rock, back in the 1970s. But watching Jackie Chan on top of the Sydney Opera House, swinging from cables and doing lots of punching and kicking was kind of fun. I mean, if there's a saving grace to Bleeding Steel, it's the fact that there's that one action sequence in there, which is just crazy and kind of enjoyable. Be part of that's because I've got an emotional investment in the Sydney Opera House. I grew up watching it being built. It took 13 or 14 years to build the Opera House, at least that. And every time I went past it, living in Sydney, and when I was growing up, there was a little bit more of it done. It was financed by lottery tickets that my parents and family bought all the time. So Opera House lottery tickets were part of the culture in which I grew up. So, but given that emotional investment, it was fun to see Jackie Chan trying to not get the shit beaten out of him on top of the Opera House. Apart from that, it's not really that great. What I suggest is see it if it turns up on Netflix or somewhere like that, but don't go out of your way to find it. Okay, so I'm going to take a break now and play the trailer for the movie du jour, Avengers Infinity War, the 19th Marvel movie since 2008, and the movie that celebrates the 10th anniversary of the MCU.
The entire time I knew him, he only ever had one goal. To wipe out half the universe. If he gets all the Infinity Stones, he can do it with the snap of his fingers. Just like that.
Tell me his name again.
Thanos.
We got one advantage. He's coming to us. We have what Thanos wants, so that's what we'll use.
Let's talk about this plan of yours. I think it's good, except it sucks. So let me do the plan, and that way it might be really good.
Wow. Still exist.
Perfectly balanced. As all things should be. I hope they remember you.
I'm Peter, by the way.
Doctor Strange.
Oh, you're using your made-up names. Then I am Spider-Man.
I don't think there's ever been a cultural phenomenon, or at least a pop cultural phenomenon, quite like the MCU, and in particular, Marvel's Avengers Infinity War. Now, I've lived through a lot of cultural phenomena, particularly pop culture. I've lived through Beatlemania, Bondmania, Batmania, Blaxploitation, piss-poor Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals, hardcore porn movies with plots and characterization, kung fu movies, Roger Corman movies, the Lucas franchise, Footloose, Gremlins, Goonies, Leprechaun movies, Pogs, Tamagotchis, reality television, Gangnam Style, and Tramp Stamps. And there's nothing that has the same Thanos-sized cultural footprint than this movie. The MCU has become what soccer used to be before FIFA was found to be corrupt as fuck. This is cinematic storytelling on an unprecedented scale. From the microscopic to the interstellar, the MCU has covered. Even people who say they don't like these movies and are suffering from that new malady of superhero fatigue know who Groot is. Avengers Infinity War is on track to make $2 billion. It's on track to be the most financially successful movie in history. It's been 10 years in the making, and there have been 18 films before it to lead up to it. So it's right at the pointy bit of the MCU, at least in this phase. I'm going to try to break it down. We all know what the plot is, because if you're listening to this, you either don't care about spoilers or you've already seen the film. So you know that it's about the mad Titan Thanos, who has this Malthusian idea that life needs to be culled because there's just simply aren't the resources in order to allow life to continue at the rate we're multiplying and expanding. It's a very Malthusian idea. Now, Malthus, the guy who thought up Malthusian ideas, like a lot of other troublemakers, was an English cleric, Thomas Robert Malthus. He was born in 1766 and died in 1834. He had this idea, and I'll read you directly from what he wrote, saying that the increase of population is necessarily limited by the means of subsistence, that the population does invariably increase when the means of subsistence increases, and that the superior power of population is repressed by moral constraint, vice, and misery. So basically what he's saying is, if there's that God determines that people keep control of their population by controlling their bestial urges so that they can have a good quality of life. Malthus also said there were two types of checks holding population within the limits of resources. Positive checks, which raise the death rate, and preventative ones, which lower the birth rate. The positive checks include hunger, disease, and war. The preventative checks are abortion, birth control, prostitution, and postponement of marriage, and also, celibacy. So Malthus had this idea that people need to control their population. Now, that's not necessarily a bad idea in itself. And it's a very simplistic idea because it doesn't take into account technological change, more available resources, and the fact that people just aren't going to stop fucking and reproducing. Thanos is the child of Malthus, just as he says that everybody is a child of Thanos. Thanos' Malthusian idea is to get all of the Infinity Stones and put them in the Infinity Gauntlet, snap his fingers, and make half of the intelligent beings, or the half of the life in the universe, disappear with the snap of a finger. He wants to do it the easy way. Now, there's a couple of problems with this. First off, it's going to cause untold misery. He tends to want a simplistic answer to incredibly complex questions, which is a very Trumpian kind of idea. You can have, by one interpretation, you can say that Thanos has the same blindness to long-term consequences as a politician like Trump does. He's about right now, getting things done right now, solving problems right now, and not worrying about what happens afterwards. A few flaws in Thanos' idea there. First one is, two or three generations time, you got the same problem again. So what's he going to do? Click his fingers again and have this ongoing, endless finger-clicking control of population thing happening? It's not going to happen that way. It's delaying the problem at best and causing untold misery. And it's a very high-handed approach as well. So Thanos is one of the three best villains in the Marvel Cinematic Universe for that reason. He's not entirely wrong. It's just his application of a solution is wrong. Now, there are two other ones that I think that follow that, and they're very recent as well. One thing Marvel has started to do is to give some heft to the villains. The first one of the three I'm talking about was Adrian Toomes in Spider-Man Homecoming, who was an understandable working-class man, ran a small business cleaning up salvage, and had a contract with the city of New York to clean up the problems after the Battle of New York in the first Avengers movies. Damage Control, the government department set up by Tony Stark, knocked his business model in the ass, and his contracts became null and void, and he went into crime. Spoiler for Spider-Man Homecoming belatedly there. So Toomes, played really great by Michael Keaton, is a villain who we understand where he's coming from. He wants to support his family well. He wants to work hard and do well. And that doesn't happen because there's not a level playing field for him, even though he has a lot of effort and a lot of financial commitment in order to run his business. So you can understand why he goes into crime. It's not the best solution. Nonetheless, it's the one that he takes because he's not left with a different way of doing things. Then we have Eric Killmonger in Black Panther, who wants Wakanda to help liberate the oppressed people around the world, because it has the technology to do so, and people of color across the world are being treated really shabbily. So you understand why he wants to do that. Killing the king and taking over the kingdom and exporting weapons is not the way to do it, but you understand the problem, if not the solution, that Eric Killmonger brings to the Black Panther movie. And in this one, you've got Thanos, who sees a problem of overpopulation and resource scarcity, and he decides he's going to snap his fingers and make it all better. So in all three cases, you understand the problem, you understand the need to find a solution to the problem, but you'd have to be a total psychopath to agree with the solutions those three gentlemen propose. So that's the bad guy. I just took a look quickly on Wikipedia, and some people have said there are 50 main characters or 49 main characters. I got about 45 from Wikipedia, and if I'm missing out any, I'm sorry about that. But so you've got 45 characters in speaking roles, all of whom have something to do with the plot. And the smart thing that the Russo brothers, who directed the film, did was splitting them up. You can't have 50 people in there, otherwise it looks like a supergroup singing We Are the World. So the movie starts with the Asgardian refugee ship being encountered by Thanos's ship, and Thanos, from the look of things, killing everybody on board pretty much. We get Loki and Thor and the Hulk going up against the Mad Titan in a scene that sets things up in such a way that we know that anything is up for grabs. Everything's possible. Major characters can die. The stakes are incredibly high. We get Thor, who's still only got one eye, at least until he meets Rocket Raccoon, waylaid, and Loki trying to be cunning and cunning his way out of the problem. This doesn't happen, of course, and Tom Hiddleston's out of the picture with a broken neck. This is the bit that pissed Sally off, because she's a big Loki fan, and having Loki killed with a broken neck right at the start of the movie pisses her off. Doesn't piss her off the fact that Thanos and Hulk go one-on-one in what looks like a bare-knuckle boxing tournament, which Thanos wins, and Hulk is then whisked away by Heimdall, who then gets stabbed by Thanos, and Heimdall's out of the way. Idris Elba's out of the business, quite possibly out of the MCU. Thanos gets the Tesseract to go along with the Power Stone that he got from the planet Xandar, and he sends the his adopted children, the Black Order, being Cull Obsidian, Ebony Maw, Proxima Midnight, and Corvus Glaive, to go to Earth to grab the two Infinity Stones which are on Earth. One being the Eye of Agamotto that Doctor Strange wears around his neck, and the other one being the Soul Stone that Vision has in his forehead. They split up into teams and head off for New York City and Scotland, because the Northern Hemisphere is the only one that matters in the MCU. Never been anything ever happened in the Southern Hemisphere, apart from South Africa briefly in Age of Ultron. But apart from that, the Southern Hemisphere of the planet doesn't get a lot of love from the MCU. So a great big donut spaceship appears over New York just as the Hulk has been rescued by Heimdall, turns back into Bruce Banner, crashes into Doctor Strange's Sanctum Sanctorum right through the roof, and he, Doctor Strange, and Tony Stark suddenly realise that shit's going down in New York, as indeed does a school student on a bus, being Peter Parker, a.k.a. Spider-Man. So the four heroes, along with Wong, who Benedict Wong really doesn't get enough love from the MCU. I would watch a Wong standalone film from the MCU, because I love Benedict Wong and his approach to the character is slightly tongue-in-cheek, but he's a lot of fun. And indeed, Doctor Strange is a lot more fun in this one than he was in the Doctor Strange movie, or indeed in the bit that he had in that post-credit sequence along with Thor. I think Benedict Cumberbatch is really getting into Doctor Strange, and in this one he does get to do some very cool stuff. In fact, everybody gets a moment to shine. We do get a lot of interesting character business with Mark Ruffalo playing Bruce Banner, with the possibility that the Hulk as PTSD from being beaten up by Thanos, which is a really nice way of sidelining Hulk, who's an incredibly powerful character and who may have skewed the narrative and skewed the plot a little bit to the superpowered side of things. And so having Hulk out of the way really does put the heroes at a disadvantage and gives us a little bit of concern, because Hulk's usually been the guy who comes in unexpectedly and tears the bad guys a new one. In this one, we don't get Hulk past that first sequence in any meaningful way, and that's a really good choice, because, to be honest with you, I like Ruffalo's Bruce Banner a lot more than I like Hulk. Yeah, Hulk does some wonderful stuff, and I would have liked to have seen more of the reunion between Black Widow and Bruce Banner as well. There's a kind of a little moment there with Scarlett Johansson and Ruffalo, but even with 2.5 hours to play with, this movie just has to lightly touch on those kind of character grace notes and move the narrative along. In Scotland, Scarlet Witch and Vision are having an assignation just to see if their relationship works. They've been kind of dancing around it for 2 years and meeting surreptitiously, thanks to the wonderfulness of the Sokovian Accords. And they get attacked by two of the Black Order while Doctor Strange, Iron Man, and Spider-Man end up on the spaceship heading back to Thanos' mothership. I really like Paul Bettany's take on Vision. I'm not as in love with Scarlet Witch, because I think that Elizabeth Olsen doesn't really have much to work with there. The Scarlet Witch is defined mostly by her relationship to men. First off, her brother, Pietro, and later on to her relationship with Vision. She doesn't have her own kind of agency in that sense, which is a little bit of a shame, but it must be frustrating for the actor as well. Black Widow is a much more nuanced character and a better written one, because we have some of her past history, and even though it is kind of a secondary role, we still look forward to a Black Widow movie because we know who the character is and we want to see more of it. Whereas with Scarlet Witch, we still don't know who the character is in any real way. Now let's do a little bit of a diversion. We'll take a look at the acting. Zoe Saldana does a great job with Gamora and Gamora's character arc and ultimately her fate. And I really like that. I don't particularly think that Chris Pratt brought his A-game to the film, but if you're going to go for the weakest link as far as the acting in this film is concerned, you've got to go with Peter Dinklage's Eitri, the dwarf who creates Stormbreaker, the enchanted axe for Thor. Dinklage's accent there is really fucking weird. He's like amateur hour trying to do an English accent, and it really doesn't work at all well. He's basically only there as a workman who comes in to manufacture something for everybody else. And while I appreciate that, he doesn't give us a sense of who the character is, apart from the fact that everybody else on the giant forge wrapped around a dead star is dead and his hands are damaged. But apart from that, even though it is not a particularly long scene, I definitely think that the weakest acting in this film is from Peter Dinklage. Part of it, of course, is the fact that the role is underwritten. But even without extending the runtime of the film, it would have been nice to see some kind of a character beat for that particular character, which we didn't get one tiny bit. Now, of course, while we're talking about acting, we've got to talk about Josh Brolin as Thanos. Remember years back when people were talking about the Uncanny Valley as far as CG was concerned in films, and how the eyes didn't look right and things weren't tracking right. And then, thankfully, motion capture became big and became the way to overcome the eeriness and the robotic artificiality of the Uncanny Valley. And I think that this is state-of-the-art as far as that's concerned. After a while, you forget that Thanos is, to a certain degree, computer-generated. And Brolin is great in this film. He's much better acting than his father ever was. And in this one, we see his kind of self-delusion, his justification for the actions he takes, the amusement he takes when somebody's not as powerful as he is. He's a complex, sadistic, and self-deluding character, which ultimately is going to lead to his downfall in the next film, of course, because he plays strong, but he's actually weak at heart. He justifies his brutality with philosophy, as indeed do many, many dictators. But in this one, it's kind of interesting, the ultimately toxic masculinity of Thanos, which he adopts children to turn into tools to further his ends. And then when he has feelings for one of those children, he uses it in a way that gets him to where he needs to be. People talk about him paying a price for his acquisition of the Soul Stone, but the price isn't paid by him. It's paid by somebody else. It's paid by Gamora in this case, and of course by the people who have become her family. Thanos, really, particularly the way he treats Nebula, and the torture scenes with Nebula are pretty brutal in this film. She's a failed tool for Thanos to get what he wants to get, and so she's treated as such. Thanos has created an army of child soldiers, particularly the top end of his military, and ultimately that will lead to his downfall. There are so many wow bits in this film. The Battle of Wakanda is terrific with, people call them the Zerg, those bestial creatures that are unleashed on Wakanda, are somewhat like the Zerg swarms that you get in the computer game StarCraft. So people are calling them the Zerg. That works really well. Seeing Wakandan military again, I'm a bit worried about the Wakandan military. In fact, they're being decimated by various bad guys. So they're really going to have to get more warriors, because they lost a hell of a lot in this battle. They lost a number of them in Black Panther as well. And the pristine Wakandan environment has pretty much been stuffed in the outer areas by those enormous war machines that Thanos unleashed upon them. And, of course, King T'Challa is no longer there. And that then leads on, of course. I'll stay on track because there are so many things to talk about. I'm very easily distracted with this. So there are the great battle scenes. There's the big battle with Thanos at the end on Titan, where he brings a moon down on the heads of the heroes, which is kind of cool and audacious. And I don't think that strictly from a physics point of view it works, but from a dramatic point of view, it definitely does get a tick. There is a great escalation in the fights in Infinity War as well. You start out with the fight in New York and the fight in Scotland. They're fairly small scale as these things go. They're about the level of some of the minor battles in other ones, where you've got a couple of super powerful villains going up against the heroes, and the heroes have to use their tactics and their smarts to overcome them. Then as things go on, the scale of the battles gets bigger and bigger as the stakes get higher and higher, because Thanos has got more and more of the Infinity Stones. I keep getting impressed by how much they crammed into this film. Just when I take a moment to pause during the recording, I suddenly think of five or six other things, the moments that Tony has with Pepper, Stephen Strange and Wong trying to work out what they're going to buy down at the deli for lunch, all those little character beats, which are fairly brief in the scale of these things, but they managed to fit them in there, along with these enormous and kind of world-changing events, which is kind of cool. We do get spend a bit of time with the Guardians of the Galaxy, but I think that it's slightly muted by the fact that James Gunn's involvement probably wasn't extensive. They do have the music beat in there. They have some of the cute dialogue between the characters. But by throwing Thor into the mix, it kind of changes that dynamic in a way, which of course is necessary for the plot of the film, but I'm not sure whether it works for supporting those characters. I'm glad the relationship between Quill and Gamora has extended beyond the as it was in the second movie. I like the fact that they do profess their love for each other, and they're kind of well-matched couple up until the point, of course, when Thanos does what he does, in the sense that both of them are damaged by their upbringing and they have various glitches based on that, but they work together to overcome them and to kind of take care of each other in a sense. Then there's Groot's puberty, of course, and Drax being same old Drax, and Rocket kind of stepping up a little bit. There's a moment in the pod where he has to be the captain of the ship and support Thor psychologically, and we see Rocket kind of growing and changing, even though he's reluctant to do so. We do see him kind of maturing in a sense, which is probably a good thing given the fact he's got the lifespan of a raccoon. But we do get a bit of an arc there, and that's going to be one of the interesting things about the second movie, because Rocket's one of the survivors in that, and how he manages that and how he takes care of business, particularly given the fact that he's an ace weaponsmith, is going to be a cool thing to see. Now, I'll probably skip forward to the ending where Thanos inevitably snaps his fingers and half of the life in the universe dies, which is kind of a weird thing, really. Half of the krill in the ocean is going to die, half of the plankton and all the other things sustaining Earth's environment are going to die. Half the microorganisms in people's bodies going to die, so suddenly everybody gets the shits because their intestinal flora has been halved. It's a very broad concept, half of life being destroyed in a moment, because you get the idea of the survivors basically running to the toilet 25 times a day. But that's just me nitpicking and getting the science geek out. So we'll assume for the sake of convenience that Thanos meant half of the sentient life in the universe has disappeared. And some of the people that I wanted to stick around got killed. Just grab my list here, because I do have a list of who got turned into ash and who stuck around. Let's see. Half of the universe disintegrates. Bucky, Drax, Groot, Mantis, Wanda, Peter Parker, Quill, Doctor Strange, T'Challa, and Sam Wilson. On the still has a pulse side of things, of course, we've got Nebula and Stark on Titan together. That's going to be interesting. And we've got Bruce Banner, M'Baku, Okoye, Rhodey, Rocket, Steve Rogers, Black Widow, and Thor are on the Wakandan battlefield. And, of course, Nick Fury and Maria Hill disintegrate while getting Captain Marvel on board. Now, that's going to be fun. A lot of people have said this movie is the Marvel Cinematic Universe's Empire Strikes Back, which is kind of a simplistic and dismissive almost approach. And, yes, that is my bias showing again. But nonetheless, I think it's definitely something of a game changer for superhero movies. That's the benchmark now. That's the standard you've got to meet to do a decent superhero movie on a large scale. And if DC has any sense, they'll probably back off and just do standalones, which I think was their plan anyway for the next foreseeable future, is to do standalones movies for the characters of which they have the rights, and then maybe later on coming back and revisiting it, because this movie does a lot of things well. It has an enormous ensemble. It has characters dying, so the emotional stakes are high. There are characters there that we've been invested in for a decade who have terrible and monstrous things happen to them. Even though, of course, some of those deaths are going to be reversed, there's a change to the universe that happens because of that. And how are the people of Earth going to react to the fact that there is a threat of that monstrousness, which has had that kind of a profound effect on the world? Are they going to wind back so that it never happened in the first place, or are they going to move forward and deal with the aftermath of that? Because it is an enormous existential change to the Earth of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and of course to the other planets and other realms of the universe as well. That brings up the other flaw that I found in Thanos' plan. Thanos hasn't taken into account the multiverse. He's talking about limited resources and life basically destroying its habitat and not having a resource. We know from the Doctor Strange movie, we also know from Ant-Man, that there are enormous numbers of realms out there. And in a sense, the theology and the world-building that occurred in the MCU tells us that there are infinite resources out there. It just takes a bit of technology to access them. So that's kind of another one of those stupid nearsighted flaws that Thanos has. He claims to be seeing the big picture, but he doesn't actually see the big picture. So this is going to be a tough year for Marvel fans overall, because we've got to wait a year before we see the shoe drop here. It's really going to be profoundly difficult to wait that long. And there's going to be petabytes of speculation on the web on what exactly is going to occur and how it's going to occur and what hints were given and what hints everything Marvel says in the next 12 months are going to give us, what hints there are in Ant-Man and the Wasp, what hints there are going to be in everything that comes out between now and the second one of these movies, which is due in May 2019. So I'm not going to speculate on that. I'll tell you one thing that I would like to see, and this is just me making connections where they probably don't exist. But if it does exist, you heard it here first. I want Hawkeye to come back in. I want Hawkeye to get Yondu's arrow, because I think that would be fucking cool. May not happen. It may just be me making associations where they don't exist. But if I was running things, that's one thing I'd add into the second movie to kind of lift things up, because I think Clint Barton could do wonderful things with Yondu's arrow. So what are the takeaways from this? Firstly, we've got a new level of storytelling to superhero narratives, and they get it right. Now, even people who are critical of it for the most part admit that it's an overwhelming, intense, mind-blowing experience to see this film, because it does do things that haven't been done before in cinema, for that matter. Nobody's told a story on this scale, whether with that many characters, all of whom have we known previously, suddenly coming together and doing this. The only time that's ever happened is in concert movies, Watts, Stax, and Woodstock, and movies like that. You get all the musicians together. It's kind of like a supergroup in a lot of ways, and literally a supergroup, I suppose. But yeah, I'm interested to see where they go with this. I know that there has been a backlash against the movie in some ways. The New Yorker did a review where they talked about it as basically an advertisement for every previous Marvel movie that came out. To a certain extent, it's true. I mean, they do make these movies to make money, ultimately, but also to have a lot of fun. There's that other aspect of it as well. But, I think that because this is a new kind of popular filmmaking, it's a game changer almost in the same way that Jaws was a game changer by creating the summer blockbuster. This movie really does do things other films haven't done. It does them very well. It does them entertainingly. I wasn't less entertained seeing this movie the second time than I was the first. And the emotional beats are right as well. Nobody really cared when Han Solo died in that Star Wars movie, because it was handled badly. And with the exception of the kind of mass random rapture at the end of the film, the deaths we see do matter. We do like Heimdall as a character, and we like Idris Elba as an actor, so when he dies, we're shocked and horrified. We do like it. A lot of people invested in Loki, particularly female friends of mine, are invested in Loki, so to see him drop off the twig early in the film had a profound effect. Gamora's death had a profound effect as well. It's one of those films where, because we like the characters and we know them previously, to have them drop out of the MCU, even though death isn't really death in these kind of movies, I think that those three are pretty much going to stick around. And there's an intensity and there's an kind of shock value in those deaths that really does make it interesting that they went there. Got to remember, by the time the next few movies have been made in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Marvel as Marvel itself has 60 years of backstory on hundreds and hundreds of characters to play with there. So this universe is only going to expand. They're not going to come to a point where they're going to say, no, we're not making any more of those. Sorry, that's not what we want to do now. We've moved on to something else. It's just not going to happen. Kids grew up reading comic books. People read them as adults. People get invested in the movies, even if they've never read the comic books, because they're good, solid entertainment at the top level of what's possible as far as technology is concerned, to show things on the screen. The actors they get, with the Dinklage exception, are the best possible actors they can get for the roles, and the plotting and the story arcs really do work. We've got a whole bunch of different genres within that superhero genre in the MCU. As I've said before, we've got the comedies, we've got the political dramas, we've got social dramas, we've got family dramas, everything you can possibly imagine, spy movies, everything you possibly imagine is rolled into the MCU within that umbrella of a world where superheroes exist. And it's not going away any more than graphic novels are going to go away in the near future. The MCU is going to continue longer than I am, probably, which is a bit sad. I want to see every movie that comes out. It's like Warren Zevon said before he died. He can't die yet. He hasn't seen the next James Bond film. The public at large is invested in the Marvel Cinematic Universe the way they were in the 60s, 70s and 80s in James Bond films. They want to see the next one. They want to know what happens. There's a lot of speculation about what's going to happen. And that's only expanded by the fact that social media now gives everyone a voice. I've looked at my YouTube feed and there have got to be thousands of videos speculating on what's going to happen next for the MCU and explaining what happened in this film. Even mainstream media is going to be invested in it. Economic news is impacted by the fact that this movie is going to be so crazily successful. In future, political dictators are going to be compared to Thanos. So it's going to kind of slowly saturate the real world in a lot of ways, particularly with a movie this profoundly interesting, intense, and ubiquitous. So I look forward to seeing where the second half of the movie goes. I don't want to wait to see it any more than other people who like the film don't want to wait to see it, but we will see it on, according to Marvel, May 3rd, 2019, with the Russo brothers directing. I believe principal photography for the second film is already completed, so they're going to be working on the effects to make them even more wonderful, and it'll be interesting to see if they do any tweaks to Thanos as well, into the mocap they do with Josh Brolin for Thanos, because each time a new Marvel movie comes out, it gets more interesting. The little bit of Thanos we saw in the first Avengers movies is incredibly primitive compared to what we've seen in this film. So as technology of movie making and effects work changes and evolves and grows and takes us to new places and is able to show us new things, I'm along for the ride. I really like particularly the things that really grabbed me in this one as far as those technologies are concerned are the Doctor Strange bits. I'm getting more and more invested in Doctor Strange as a character. I really like him. I think Cumberbatch has brought his A-game to it. And even though he's turned to dust, I know he's going to be back. And I like the fact that he doesn't come from things from a scientific viewpoint or from the greedy viewpoint of the Guardians of the Galaxy. He comes from a magical, mystical viewpoint, and he's the master of the mystic arts and the sorcerer supreme of the Earth, or in fact of our universe, I'm not sure which. But yeah, Doctor Strange is my guy for this one, in the same way that for a lot of friends of mine, it's T'Challa. For teenagers, it may be Spider-Man. For women, it may be Captain Marvel or even Wonder Woman. But, yeah, there are characters in these films, DC or Marvel, with whom we identify and in whom we have a really strange but kind of new fondness, which is not a bad thing. Having positive emotions about things is not a bad thing. And the cinematic universe created by Marvel / Disney is something new in cinema. It's really I'll keep saying game changer, but I've got to try to find another term to use for that. It's a paradigm shift in the way popular cinema entertainments are done. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that I want to see more superhero movies. I want to see diverse superhero movies. I want to see other people's stories told in the same way that they were in Black Panther. I want to see Australian superheroes, for fuck's sake. There aren't many in the comics at all, but I want to see Singaporean superheroes and Indian superheroes, Japanese and Chinese and Korean and Islander peoples. I want to see South American superheroes more, not just as different iterations of existing superheroes, but as heroes and as characters with their own agency and not just Spider-Man done ethnic. I want to see all those kind of things because it's fun. I'm invested in it. My house is decorated with superheroes of all kinds everywhere. It's really tragic in some ways. But nonetheless, I enjoyed this movie a lot, as you might have guessed by this stage. And I'm going to really look forward to seeing future Marvel movies. I think it's going to be good to see Ant-Man and Wasp as a kind of light-hearted circuit breaker to get rid of that emotional tension that we've had from Avengers Infinity War. I even want to see the Aquaman movie, though I'm not optimistic about it. I'm sure that DC are going to tweak it in reaction to Avengers Infinity War, particularly if the villain's kind of weak, and not just make the villain a kind of Killmonger with gills kind of character. But we'll see what happens there. The future's bright as far as superhero movies are concerned, and genre films in particular as well. I know Netflix are going to be skewing their original productions a lot more to science fiction and fantasy, because that's where the eyes are, where people, the things that people are actually watching. And from the viewpoint of this particular long-term science fiction geek, that ain't a bad thing. So I'm going to leave it there before I gush and start repeating myself too many times about the same things. Thank you for listening. Thank you for putting up with the spoilers. Let me know what you think. I would like some feedback on this one. So you can do it through Facebook at the Paleo Cinema Cafe. You can send me an email with a voicemail attached to it. You can just send me an email. Or you can even just do it on Facebook as well. So take care of yourselves. Try the credits, of course, are here. There's no post-credit sequence in this particular podcast, but the credits are here to honour the people who support the podcast via Patreon. Hope you enjoyed the film too. Look after yourselves. Take care. I'll be back soon with another Paleo Cinema podcast and then with another Martian Drive-In podcast. Catch you later. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema podcast and Martian Drive-In podcast, done in the style of film credits. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the Technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our Foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, the second unit director, Paul, the special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our script doctor, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, the set security lead, Richard H., the set photographer, Mark D., the extra, David L., the extra, and Richard C., our transport co-captain, plus Andrew, our necessary film critic. We have Kerry H., our accountant, and Kerry L., our other spiritual advisor. Thank you so much to all the patrons for dipping into their pockets and helping out with the podcast. This has been a Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In production. The end.